welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Okay, welcome back. Folks, we're going to kind of bypass the obligatories. And the reason why is because we're kind of doing a lot of new things and trying to get the radio show done on a regular basis. So today's radio show was done in a different way. Obviously, last week, the last one that Tammy and I did was done differently as well. So we're kind of going through trial and error. We've got a lot of equipment, got the software, everything else. It's just trying to integrate the best process of trying to do this really quick. So without any further ado, what I want to do is just go ahead and kind of run right into the show. We're going to be diving into the Pennsylvania ratification debates right where we kind of left off. And so welcome back, Tammy. And let's dive into the Pennsylvania debates. Now, we just kind of wrapped up the enumerated powers. And so now what we want to do, because there's this little part in here that actually highlights the importance of the consent of suffrage. So let's go ahead and read that, if you would
mind. Okay. Let us proceed now to the second branch of the legislative department and the system before you, the senators, sir, those tyrants that are to devour the legislatures of the states, are to be chosen by the state legislatures themselves. Need anything more be said on this subject? So far as the principle of each state's retaining the power of self-preservation from being weakened or endangered by the general government, that the convention went further, perhaps, than was strictly proper in order to secure it. For in this second branch of the legislature, each state, without regard to its importance, is entitled to an equal vote. And in the articles respecting amendments of this Constitution, it is provided that no state, without its consent, shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. Okay. Does it appear...
Now it appears that he connected the dots right here for us. As far as I'm concerned, he basically said that these people are to be chosen by the state legislatures, and that's their suffrage. So what changed with the 17th Amendment was the 17th Amendment, they're no longer selected by them, but it doesn't mean that they lose their suffrage, because right here it says that no state without its consent, because the 17th Amendment didn't change this clause in Article 5, they still have their right of suffrage. And
right.
Here we have it stipulated that this can't be. Okay, so go ahead. Now this final...
Okay. Does it appear, then, that provision for the continuance of the state governments was neglected in framing this Constitution? On the contrary, it was a favorite object in the convention to secure them.
Okay, so... Let's go ahead and dive down to the next day, December 1st. And we want to look at the comments regarding regulate taxation.
Okay, but I believe this doctrine is a very disagreeable one to some of the state governments. All the objects that will furnish an increase of revenue are eagerly seized by them. Perhaps this will lead to the reason why a state government, when she was obliged to pay only about an eighth part of the loan office certificate, should voluntarily undertake the payment of about one-third part of them. This power of taxation will be regulated in the general government upon equitable principles. No state can have more than her just proportion to discharge. No longer will government be obliged to assign her funds for the payment of debts she does not owe. Another objection has been taken, that the judicial powers are coextensive with the objects of the national government. As far as I can understand the idea of magistracy in every government, this seems to be a proper arrangement. The judicial department is considered as a part of the executive authority of government. Now, I have no idea that the authority should be restricted so as not to be able to perform its functions with full effect. I would not have the legislature sit to make laws which cannot be executed. It is not meant here that the law shall be dead, shall be a dead letter. It is meant that they shall be carefully and duly considered before they are enacted, and that then they shall be honestly and faithfully executed. This observation naturally leads to a more particular consideration of the government before us. In order, sir, to give permanency, stability, and security to any government, I conceive it of essential importance that its legislature should be restrained, that there should not only be what we call a passive, but an active power over it. For of all kinds of despotism, this is the most dreadful and the most difficult to be corrected. With how much contempt have we seen the authority of the people treated by the legislature of this state, and how often have we seen it making laws in one session that have been repealed the next, either on account of the fluctuation of party or on or their own impropriety.
There you go. So, so he's kind of talking really in general regarding the regulation of taxes, but the fact is, now that the federal government actually has coercive power, they actually can come in and levy a tax and say, you owe us this money. And so there's different ways of taxation. Now, one of the problems is that right now, in day one, they don't have a stable currency. The Constitution has to create that. So from the beginning of this government into the first 4, 5, 10 years, they actually have to start creating a specie. And when I say creating, it's not like an alchemist, right? Where you know, you go in and use chemicals to kind of create fool's gold or what have you. They actually have to start mining and bringing forward gold and silver. And they actually have to start putting gold and silver into the currency, because what is the state supposed to pay the federal government? What is in the Constitution the species for the payment of debt? The legal tender for payment of debt is gold and silver coin. It mm-hmm. doesn't exist yet. So this mm-hmm. is one of those things that, you know, they have to get there. It's not something that they, you know, when the Constitution gets ratified, gold falls from heaven. So they have to come up with policies and ways. And I will tip my hat on Alexander Hamilton's first act, because the way I see it, he was basically rewarding people to bring gold and silver into the treasury or into the minting system and into the currency by basically bringing your gold and silver, and you would get that in equivalent to its monetary value. In other words, you bring in an ounce, you get an ounce coin. In other words, it's a complete transmutation and, you know, a transference of one into actual species of an equal value. So, it, you know, I guess you keep the little, you know, little left over, because, you know, what do they do, you know, if it's more than an ounce, okay, you keep that and bring back more and you can have, you know, give you another ounce. That's how they basically charge the currency system, so that people could actually start paying debt. They already had debt that the states owed, but the Continental Congress was unable to collect, so they couldn't pay that debt. Now, the Constitution, this is kind of interesting. What they ended up doing was they acknowledged that those debts would be maintained, and now they gave the federal government the ability to actually pay those debts, you know, be able to coercively go and get that. They realize, and we've covered this last year, we're going to cover it again this year, but they realize some of these problems du jour that they're having, because some states don't have any species because they just don't have that kind of currency flowing through them. The northern states were just that. The states in the south actually had more currency because they were cash crop states. I mean, the tobacco was a currency, and so they were able to, you know, maintain and pay their debts, and that's why the southern states were the first ones to pay their debt and get out of debt. So unbeknownst to anybody, you know, Hamilton went down and bypassed the Constitution and created the bank. And we'll get into that down the road. But what they had to do to get there would have been very cumbersome and very difficult. And unfortunately, instead of doing it right, the cumbersome, difficult way, Hamilton just basically took the easy way out by violating the Constitution. Now, I've said this before, and I don't know if I've said this to you, but it's a transgression, right? You violate the Constitution. When you do it once in this one capacity to do one thing, it is actualized and done. In other words, he assumed the debt. Okay, now we actualize the debt. We're going to pay it off. It's not like, oh, well, as long as you keep accruing debt, we'll pay for it. They didn't do that. They didn't create a perpetual system that was going to, you know, continually undermine us. What it was a one-time thing that they did. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
The advantage of that is the fact that they are running down this path of doing this one-time thing and then getting it paid for and done. And so as we kind of move through the process, as we kind of go down, you know, into the follow-on years, now Hamilton basically says the kicker was the bank. They assumed the debt. They were going to actualize that. It was a one-time transgression. My point is that even though the bank was one thing that they did to kind of service that, Hamilton created a bank that was going to become a perpetual bank that was going to create products. In other words, they were going to sell bonds. They were going to actually make money by playing with money. And that was something that wasn't necessary. And so that was one of the reasons why Jefferson and Madison went, you know, hard wild in getting rid of that. I mean, they hog wild, I should say. They basically bore down and said, we're going to, you know, get out from underneath this debt and this bank. And so they did that. But the problem was that we got attacked, and that forced us to actually, Madison went and created another bank. So it was another transgression. But these types of transgressions, even though they were bad, and they make it easier to do it again and again, they're not a permanent, you know, skin extraction from the people. In other words, the types of violations that Madison and Jefferson were very, very concerned about were these inalienable rights, your freedom of speech, the freedom of press. When the people's rights were being taken, those don't come back. A expenditure of money one time as a transgression is bad. It's wrong. It's a sin. But it's a sin that the nation can overcome. It's kind of like Social Security. It's a sin. They shouldn't have been doing it, but we can overcome this. But when government actually says you don't have a right of conscience anymore, you don't have the right of petitioning, you don't have the right to, you know, hold us accountable, when they do those types of things, then that is a real warning that we are in the throes of tyranny, because they are attacking us as directly as we, the people, and our inalienable rights, our rights as parents and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So as we kind of go down this path, we need to look at, you know, as they ratified this and started doing these things, there were these transgressions. And so there's lots of people in the patriot movements that are, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent. They're binary on it. Oh, that's wrong. It's wrong. It's wrong. It's wrong. It's wrong. It's wrong till, you know, till Wednesday. Or every day of the week and every day of the month, every day of the year, it's just wrong. And so when we look at what we need to do in fixing those types of transgressions, if it's a one-time transgression, we just have to overcome that and get right. That's the whole point of government, getting right. Getting compliance and getting right. But when we actually have surrendered where government is doing things, when we give them power... See, the beautiful thing is, folks, they don't have power over our speech. They don't have power over our persons and our effects. these things, they don't, if they've created any law, they're not legitimate. We can take all of those things back. But when they actually amend the Constitution to say the federal government will now regulate, let's go with the balanced budget, right? Because the balanced budget is one of those amendments that the Convention of State folks are pushing. And they actually say that as long as the federal government spends this amount of money, you know, within this tie to the GDP, if the GDP is this, then they can spend this much money. What that does is it all of a sudden takes away the enumerated objects that they can spend money on and says, well, it doesn't matter what you spend money on, you can spend that much. So now they're no longer limited to the objects in the Constitution, to only spending money on the militia, national defense, and these things, you know, forts, magazines, that type of stuff, national security, those very few objects that they have. Now they can just spend money to give to corporations. Because it's okay to spend any kind of money because it doesn't enumerate it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It's basically putting a huge hole. A balanced budget amendment puts a huge hole in the Constitution. What's wrong with saying, hold on here, you can't spend money on anything that it's not enumerated? Like this housing, this Department of Housing, this Department of Environmental Protection Services, so forth and so on. So as we, you know, kind of get our arms wrapped around this, we start looking at what we, you know, really need to do. I'm of the opinion that we need to make sure that they have the active power over enumerated objects, and that is it, and all the spending and so forth. The point is that when we're looking at the enumerations and they're going through these things, we're going to find, and folks, when you read these things by yourself, you're going to find these objects or these arguments coming from Patrick Henry. They're going to be coming from these great men that are doing everything they can to convince you not to, you know, get into this Constitution, not to ratify it. Let's not go down this path. Let's just keep everything the way it is. If they had their way, then what they would be stipulating, because when Patrick Henry says, if you do this, then they're going to take your militia away from you. The only way, as they stipulated the militia in the ratification base, the only way Mason's assertion or Henry's assertion that you're going to lose your militia at the state level is if the federal government actually violates the Constitution and doesn't follow those stipulations and those enumerated objects within that government. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, as we're looking at these things, when we're going through these, I just want to make sure that, you know, we're covering these things as they go along. And one of the things that Wilson's going to talk a lot about, he's going to talk about the power of the people. And this is something that the reason we're doing this, focusing on that, is because of the whole point of interposition has to come from the people. You know, when you allow government to basically create a den of thieves, then they create an honor system among thieves. I won't hold you accountable. We won't hold anybody accountable. So the only way that accountability can be restored is how? By the power of the people. The people have to demand it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To start interposing, they have to start petitioning, and they have to put their foot down and say, you will comply, get out. You're violating your oath, you have no business being in there anymore. And so with that, well, let's just go ahead and dive down to the necessary and proper clause, where he kind of jumps into this as well, because this is one of the problems they have. When you read the necessary and proper clause, it says they can make all powers necessary and proper, but there's not a semicolon after that necessary and proper. It is necessary and proper and to carry into execution the foregoing powers. So when we read this, it's actually in this next part, he's going to quote it. Look at the punctuation. Is there a semicolon? Is there a comma? What? How is that punctuated? Is that basically one statement? Because it is one statement, and the way they frame it is they frame it like, oh, well, we can do anything necessary and proper. As long as you don't read the remaining part of the statement. Yeah.
Right.
They take it out of context. Okay, so let's go ahead and read this.
Okay. The gentleman in opposition strongly insists that the general clause at the end of the 8th section gives to Congress a power of legislating generally, but I cannot conceive by what means he will render the words susceptible of that expansion. Can the words, "the Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper to carry into execution the foregoing powers," be capable of giving them general legislative power? I hope that it is not meant to give to Congress merely an elusive show of authority to deceive themselves or constituents any longer. On the contrary, I trust it is meant that they shall have the power of carrying into effect the laws with which they shall make under the powers vested in them by this Constitution. In answer to the gentleman from Fayette, Mr. Smiley? Mr. Smiley, on the subject of the press, I beg leave to make an observation. It is very true, sir, that the Constitution says nothing with regard to that subject, nor was it necessary, because it will be found that there is given to the general government no power whatsoever concerning it, and no law in pursuance of the Constitution can possibly be enacted to destroy that liberty.
Okay, so when we look at Congress shall have the power, that clause right there in, you know, the top of that paragraph, or the top of the page, the power to make laws which shall be necessary and proper to carry into execution the foregoing powers. Is there any punctuation in that? That is one statement. So in other words, they do not have just arbitrary or just full necessary, they can do any laws necessary and proper. No, necessary and proper to carry into execution the foregoing powers. So in other words, necessary and proper clause is not a power. It is a stipulation that they can, if you look at the uniform rule, that the Congress shall have the power to make a uniform rule of naturalization, which means that they can then make a necessary and proper law to carry that into execution so that they can actually make a law that would be transmitted amongst the states to say, this is how you will naturalize citizens as United States citizens, so that it's uniform. They have to create the uniform rule of naturalization. They also have granted this, and when in an upcoming ratification debate, we're going to find out that it says, well, they could have just said, you know, and then listed the power, that they have the power to make a uniform rule of naturalization and laws concerning bankruptcy, uniform rules of bankruptcy, and then include, and that will have the necessary and proper powers to, you know, to make laws that are necessary and proper to carry out this power. At the end of each sentence, somebody said, well, what if they just put it at the end of each sentence? Would that be okay? Because all we did was, instead of putting it at the end of each sentence, we put it at the end of all the powers and said, you know, you can make the necessary and proper laws to carry into execution these powers, these foregoing powers. Why was this such a big deal? Well, because the reality is, down the road, these people actually create the context to say, you know what, if we actually don't say those foregoing powers, this is how people will read the Constitution, and like reading scripture, if you're not reading the full context of what you're reading, they can twist it, they can redefine it, they can put something there that isn't actually there. So, as we kind of look at that and we kind of move forward, let's go down into the, I think this is where we talk about general powers. So no general power. In other words, what he was basically saying up here is that there was really no general power, that they were all very enumerated and very explicit. So if you go to the amendment.
Okay. I beg to make one remark on what one gentleman has said with respect to amendments being proposed to this Constitution. to whom are the convention to make report of such amendments? He tells you, to the present Congress. I do not wish to report to that body the representatives only of the state governments. They may not be disposed to admit the people into participation of their power. It has also been supposed that a wonderful unanimity, unanimity subsists among those who are enemies to the proposed system. On this point, I also differ from the gentleman who made the observation. I have taken every pains in my power and read every publication I could meet with in order to gain information, and as far as I have been able to judge, the opposition is inconsiderable and inconsistent. Instead of agreeing in their objections, those who make them bring forward such as are diametrically opposite. On one hand, it is said that the representation in Congress is too small. On the other, it is said to be too numerous. Some think the authority of the Senate too great, some that the House of Representatives, and some that of both. Others draw their fears from the powers of the President, and like the iron race of Cadmus, these opponents rise only to destroy each other.
Okay, so he's kind of pointing out with the fact that, you know, they can make amendments. And as a matter of fact, they do make amendments. They actually get there. They actually do a great job in identifying amendments and going down this path of the Bill of Rights, the 11th Amendment. I mean, the states came in, we've kind of covered this before, folks, but over half of all amendments have come from the states. The Congress didn't inflict the amendments upon us. They did it because of the behesting of the states. The 14th Amendment was one of those that was actually somewhat done within Congress, but, I mean, to be honest, the reason Congress existed and the reason we got to a point of the Civil War was this thing called the abolition movement. We wanted all people to be free, or the majority of the northern states. The southern states seceded. We fought a war. And so the ultimate end was not to basically say we're ending slavery, but you could still kill those people. I mean, that would have been basically hypocrisy to its fullest. The point is that this drive of making and protecting the life and liberty of all people in America had to be galvanized. It had to be protected. And the government required, and so I will say that the 14th Amendment actually came from the federal government, but in essence, it came from the states. Does that make sense? Because the Prohibition Amendment literally was a movement among the states. The Bill of Rights, it was a movement among the states. But this movement of the abolition, the federal government finally stepped in and they violated the Constitution when the southern states started seceding by declaring war. Lincoln went about it all wrong. I don't have any respect for the guy, but I believe that he was hardened and he had a hard heart and he was basically going to use any means necessary, whether it was gentle or not. But I mean, I think that he was kind of prepared by the divine hand of providence to kind of take care of the problem. And as soon as he took care of the problem, then he was taken from the earth. Because I dread to think, what would have happened if Lincoln would have maintained his presidency? Because he was a tyrant, and he would have maintained tyrannical control, and there was no way Congress would have been able to do what it did. I've heard people say the 14th Amendment came from Lincoln. No, it didn't. The Civil Rights Act may have came from Lincoln. It was actually the actualization, because they actually passed the Civil Rights Act. I'm just going to go down this rat hole real quick, because we've kind of talking about this on Friday and on Monday. So the Civil Rights Act of 1866 was passed, and Johnson basically vetoed it, and they had two-thirds of both houses actually vote to pass the Civil Rights Act. And then Johnson laughed and goes, well, that's nice, but it's not constitutional. You can't inflict those laws and those principles in that act upon the states. You can only do that if it's an amendment. And that's when, you know, because I think Lincoln would have done it. I think Lincoln would have just done it instead of worrying about an amendment. He would have done whatever was necessary because he was that kind of tyrant. People died in prison that, you know, he was, I'll just say, people that were, you know, disparaging and criticizing him. He took away habeas corpus, and people died in prison or captivity because he was a tyrant. Anyway, so back to the next one. We want to talk a little bit about these slaves and this whole point, because this is where we're going to find the premise or the theory that the Constitution would actually end slavery.
Okay. Much fault has been found with the mode of expression used in the first clause of the ninth section of the first article. I believe I can assign a reason why that mode of expression was used and why the term slave was not admitted in this Constitution. And as to the manner of laying taxes, this is not the first time that the subject has come into the view of the United States and of the legislatures of the several states. The gentleman, Mr. Findley, will recollect that in the present Congress, the quota of the federal debt and general expenses was to be in proportion to the value of land and other enumerated property within states. After trying this for a number of years, it was found on all hands to be a mode that could not be carried into execution. Congress were satisfied of this in the year and in the year 1783 recommended, in conformity with the powers they possessed under the Articles of Confederation, that the quota should be according to the number of free people, including those bound to servitude and excluding Indians not taxed. These were the expressions used in 1783, and the fate of this recommendation was similar to all their other resolutions. It was not carried into effect, but it was adopted by no fewer than 11 out of the 13 states, and it cannot but be matter of surprise to hear gentlemen who agreed to this very mode of expression at that time come forward and state it as an objection on the present occasion. It was natural, sir, for the late convention to adopt the mode after it had been agreed to by 11 states and to use the expression which they found had been received as unacceptable before.
Okay, so he's setting the stage because there's a lot we're going to cover. But go ahead into the next one, because eventually when we have the aha, see? But here he's laying it out to say, you guys have problems with the language of the Constitution when we're using the exact same language, the Continental Congress, and you're saying, oh, we got to keep that, we got to keep that. Well, we are keeping it. What's your problem?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's go ahead. Slavery and new slavery.
Okay. With respect to the clause restricting Congress from prohibiting the migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit, prior to the year 1808, the Honorable Gentleman says that this clause is not only dark, but intended to grant to Congress for that time the power to admit the importation of slaves. No such thing was intended, but I will tell you what was done, and it gives me high pleasure that so much was done. Under the present Confederation, the states may admit the importation of slaves as long as they please, but by this article, after the year 1808, the Congress will have power to prohibit such importation, notwithstanding the disposition of any state to the contrary. I consider this as laying the foundation for banishing slavery out of this country. And though the period...
So you see that?
Yeah.
I consider this as laying the foundation for banishing slavery out of this country. I think he's pretty clear with that. And so...
yeah.
That hyperbole, and actually, he was right, because the Monroe Doctrine proves it. Because we finally got to a point where the southern states said, you know what? We're going to lose slavery if we don't do something to preserve it better, because we can't import slaves anymore. So after the 1808 shutdown, and they actually did shut down the importation of slaves, and they were trying to expand the franchise of slavery across the United States, and got away with the Missouri Compromise and galvanized, making the federal government to inflict slavery all unconstitutional. The point is that the way the Constitution was, had they complied, slavery would have been eradicated. Because had the Missouri Compromise not been passed, had it not, had they not violated the Constitution, went down that path, the states, the new states joining the Union, would have been free slave, free state. They would not have permitted slavery, and we would have gotten to a point where both the Senate, as well as the House of Representatives, because of the great expanse of the United States, they, because it would have been denned, it would have been contained right there in these, this, the southern few states, you know, possibly, because I believe Alabama, Mississippi, those states actually extended slavery. But from Louisiana on, no. They weren't slave states.
Mm-hmm.
So, the point is that, you know, here, I told you, he was setting the stage and he did it. So go ahead and keep mm-hmm. going.
Okay. So I'm going to read that sentence again. I consider this as laying foundation for banishing slavery out of this country, and though the period is more distant than I could wish, yet it will produce the same kind gradual change which was pursued in Pennsylvania. It is with much satisfaction I view this power in the general government, whereby they may lay an interdiction on this reproachful trade. But an immediate advantage is also obtained, for a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation, not exceeding $10 for each person. And this, sir, operates as a partial prohibition. Good point. It was all that could be obtained. I am sorry it was no more. But from this, I think there is reason to hope that yet a few years and it will be prohibited altogether. And in the meantime, the new states which are to be formed will be under the control of Congress and this particular, and slaves will never be introduced amongst them. The gentleman says that it is unfortunate in another point of view. It means to prohibit the introduction of white people from Europe, as this tax may deter them from coming amongst us. A little impartiality and attention will discover the care that the convention took in selecting their language. The words are, hold on, let me scroll down, the migration or importation of such persons, etc., shall not be prohibited by Congress prior to the year 1808, but a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation. It is observable here that the term migration is dropped when a tax or duty is mentioned, so that Congress have power to impose the tax only on those imported.
Okay, so do you understand the difference between importation and migration? People that migrate, or a person, back in those days, a person just got on the ship and said, hey, I want to go there, and they came, you know, took their chance. But over time, we started getting organized. Well, actually, the federal government took the initiative, but they had no constitutional authority to get involved in immigration. Each state should have actually had their own immigration process to say, you know what, if you want to come here, you need to get approval from one of us, one of the states, and so let us know, you know, contact us, because it was a direct importation into that state. So technically, they didn't have airplanes. They couldn't just fly into that state. So there was a process of getting on a boat, getting into a port, and then traveling from that port to that state. Some people were just coming here without any real plans and then said, well, where's a good place right now? Okay, I'll go there. And that's where they went. The point being is that the federal government had no control over the growth and the type of people that were going to be admitted into the states for immigration. Some states were favoring the French. They weren't favoring the Anglicans. They didn't trust the British. They only were trusting the French or the other European nations.
Yeah.
They were favoring the British. They had full control over who came in. And that's exactly what he's saying here. It is observable here that the term migration is dropped when a tax or duty is mentioned. so that Congress may have the power to impose tax only on those imported, not on migrating. So in other words, the states still have full control, folks. It was never a power given to them in Article 1, Section 8. What we're reading here is the restriction on the federal government. So, okay. And also the restriction placed upon the states. But let's go down to the next one where Mr. Wilson talks a little bit more about enumeration.
Okay. A good deal has already been said concerning a Bill of Rights. I have stated, according to the best of my recollection, all that passed in convention related to that business. Since that time, I have spoken with a gentleman who has not only his memory but full notes that he had taken in that body, and he assures me that upon this subject no direct motion was ever made at all, and certainly before we heard this so violently supported out of doors, some pains ought to have been taken to have tried its fate within. But the truth is, a Bill of Rights would, as I have mentioned already, have been not only unnecessary but improper. In some governments, it may come within the gentleman's idea when he says it can do no harm, but even in these governments, you find Bill of Rights do not uniformly obtain, and do those states complain who have them not. It is a maxim in forming governments that not only all the powers which are given, but also that all those which are reserved should be enumerated. I apprehend that the powers given and reserved form the whole rights of the people as men and as citizens. I consider that there are very few who understand the whole of these rights. All the political writers from Grotius and Pufendorf down to Vattel have treated on this subject, but in no one of those books, nor in the aggregate of them all, can you find a complete enumeration of rights appertaining to the people as men and as citizens. There are two kinds of government: that where general power is intended to be given to the legislature, and that where the powers are particularly enumerated. In the last case, the implied result is that nothing more is intended to be given than what is so enumerated, unless it results from the nature of the government itself. On the other hand, when general legislative powers are given, then the people part with their authority, and on the gentleman's principle of government, retain nothing. But in a government like the proposed one, there can be no necessity for a Bill of Rights, for on my principle, the people never part with their power.
There you go. So, very powerful stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we go through all of these debates, you're going to be surprised that there's really nothing there where the federal say, well, even though we enumerate it, the federal government can really do whatever they want. They hold the ground. They're a buttress against the onslaught of lies and seditious, I'll just say, disparaging, licentious comments coming from the anti-federalists, trying to convince people that, oh, well, they still can do bad things. And actually, it even comes up, I think, in one of the debates. It says, yeah, any person could do bad things, regardless of whether they have the power to do it or not. Right? I mean, it doesn't matter. The Continental Congress, under the Articles of Confederation, could do bad things. It's the same thing with this. So what are you saying? So let's go down to sovereignty and supreme.
Okay. In this confederated republic, the sovereignty of the states, it is said, is not preserved. We are told that there cannot be two sovereign powers, and that a subordinate sovereignty is no sovereignty. It will be worthwhile, Mr. President, to consider this objection at large. When I had the honor of speaking formally on this subject, I stated, in as concise a manner as possible, the leading ideas that occurred to me to ascertain whether the supreme and sovereign power resides. It has not been, nor I presume will it be denied, that somewhere there is, and of necessity must be, a supreme, absolute, and uncontrollable authority. This, I believe, may justly be termed the sovereign power, for from that gentleman's, Mr. Findlay's, account of the matter, it can't be sovereign unless it is supreme. For, says he, a subordinate sovereignty is no sovereignty at all. I had the honor of observing that, if the question was asked, where the supreme power resided, different answers would be given by different writers. I mentioned that Blackstone will tell you that in Britain it is lodged in the British Parliament. And I believe there is no writer on this subject on the other side of the Atlantic but supposed it to be vested in that body. I stated further that if the question was asked of some politician who had not considered the subject with sufficient accuracy, where the supreme power resided in our government, in our governments, he would answer that it was vested in the state constitutions. This opinion approaches near the truth, but does not reach it. For the truth is that the supreme, absolute, and uncontrollable authority remains with the people. I mentioned also that the practical recognition of this truth was reserved for the honor of this country. I recollect no constitution founded on this principle, but we have witnessed the improvement and enjoy the happiness of seeing it carried into practice. The great and penetrating mind of Locke seems to be the only one that pointed towards even the theory of this great truth.
Okay, so he's really kind of diving in these different directions, but he points out that really, when you really look at where the sovereignty is between the federal and the state, the states are the sovereigns. Because the federal government can only do those very few things. Powers not delegated to the federal government are reserved to the states. But here's the best thing. If the people didn't delegate the power to the states, then the states don't even have that power. It's reserved to
right.
the people and our counties. This is the whole structure. They didn't really understand a trifecta. They had a hard time understanding a duality between a federal government that had limited powers and these states that had powers, but you know, they couldn't conduct war, they couldn't, you know, tax each other, but they were autonomous and sovereign, and they had full sovereignty over all things within their state. So it was hard for them to actually try to create this relationship of the, you know, the one to the few, and then the few to the one, and then, you know, even a fewer to a one, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So
when you look at it, you may have, you know, 30,000, 50,000 to a county, but that's the people. So we, the people, create a county government. We create a constitution. We delegate power to them. We didn't do a good job because we never created those constitutions, but it doesn't mean we can't. We still have the power to institute it properly. We can declare that we want a constitution to delegate to you these very specific powers, so you're not going to be able to pull the wool over our eyes anymore. Therefore, we form this convention, we go in, we create this constitution, and we say these are the only powers you're going to get. And then we say, but this constitution is predicated upon the ratification of a new state constitution. Because you can't actually pull the wool out from underneath the existing apparatus of chaos that has been created because the counties were never organized. Because the state is running around like it is the god of everything. But it's the administrator and the flunky for the federal government, the bureau. I mean, that's how chaotic it is, folks. So once you have enough counties that have actually created their constitution, then they basically go into a convention that will actually rewrite that state constitution, and then the ratification of that constitution will only require a certain percentage of counties. Ergo, it will no longer be done based on popular vote. It will be done just like the federal government. It required 9 states to ratify this constitution. I would basically say that any amendment and the ratification of a state constitution should at least require 2/3, if not, you know, 3/4, somewhere in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
70%, you know, 70% of the counties, whatever. that way, you have a true majority of governing bodies as well as the people. It's not about popular majority. It is about, because these communities, this is where people wanted to live. If you wanted to live on the coast, you'd live on the coast. If you wanted to live at the top of the volcano, you'd live there. Not a lot of people would survive on top of the volcano, but nevertheless, you could live there. Nobody's going to stop. But the point is this, is that they really weren't understanding this depth of this hybrid republic, because technically the state is a republic. It's a republic of counties, just like the government is a republic of states. And within the counties, you can even have a republic of districts, a republic of law, because we now have counties that are so populated that literally require a sub-element government of a republic within it, to where the people can actually get proper representation. We've talked about this. And but the whole point is, everybody thinks that government is supposed to be, you know, pay all these extra bills and stuff. No. They're not to be they're not to be the richest people, and it's us. We, the people, are a self-governing people. We have to be that government. In other words, it's a duty. It's a responsibility. Yeah, everybody wants to be able to do 1 year and retire, right? Who doesn't? Who doesn't want to just work 1 year of their life and retire? But that's not reasonable, especially at the expense of everybody else. It's just wrong. So I think that, you know, those people who serve in the legislative capacity probably should be, you know, compensated better, especially at the county level, you know, county and maybe the state level. But Congress, they don't have that much to do. Congress could actually, they're overpaid. Congress should actually take a huge pay cut, because when we really look at it, you know, as if we have proper representation, that, and we the people are actively engaged in telling Congress exactly how to, you know, how to use our suffrage, because that's what it is, right? The senators are basically the proxy for the state legislature, and your representative is the proxy for the 30,000 people in that legislature or congressional district.
Right.
So when you have communities, you'll actually find that you can get a good consensus out of 30,000 people. But when you have a million strewn across, you know, the entire state of Wyoming, then you've got people all over the map. Because they don't care, you know, nobody cares about anything other than what's important to them. That's why, you know, this design of this republic was to make sure that we were protecting the interest of the small communities. Their interest of coal mining, their interest of timber, their interest of growing food or raising cattle, fishing, whatever. They're very different and disparate, and they all need to have protection from others to, you know, to basically mow them down and so forth. We're running out of time. I really appreciate the fact that...
So let me get back into this recording fiasco today, the past couple of days. I apologize. Skype went away. They pulled the rug out from underneath us. I'm not going to go into Teams. We maintain Skype because of its autonomy. It didn't know who you were, what have you. We're not going to go into Teams. We don't want to be a part of big tech knowing who we are, where we're broadcasting. We don't want them to have that information. So all things being equal, what we're trying to do is we're trying to integrate an ability to give you a radio show that is under the wire, where big tech is not going to be directly involved. Big tech is not going to be big brother for us. We want to talk the talk and walk the walk. So in our next show, we are making another change. And I think that these changes, as we move forward, will get better and better so that we can provide you with a good, consistent quality show instead of my voice being faint in like today's show versus, you know, in the past, where everybody else's voice was faint. Anyway, all things being equal, we're doing our best. We appreciate your patience and perseverance. And as I always say, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.